Good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to invite you to turn with me to Romans chapter 15. Romans chapter 15. And I'm going to read verse 4. Romans chapter 15 and verse 4. It says, "For whatsoever things were written aforetime." And of course, we're talking about the scriptures, right? Whatever was written in the scriptures were written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort of the scriptures, might have hope. So sometimes we come across portions of the Bible that are kind of difficult to understand or whatever. It was written for us, one way or another. We're going to be looking at Daniel 11, and that's a subject that is not often studied by most people. Now, there are certain groups where it's big discussion, but sometimes we get lost in some of the detail. So if you'd like to turn to the book of Daniel, chapter 11, I would like to notice some things. We're only going to get halfway through the chapter today. We're not going to try to deal with those last parts of the chapter, which is where most of the debate usually comes. We're going to be focusing on the parts that most people agree to and understand and accept. And the reason that I read that scripture in Romans is because of the fact that it was written, even those things that may be sometimes difficult to understand, was written for our learning so that we, through the comfort of the scriptures, might have hope. That's the purpose of this, even if it's stuff that we're not really that familiar with. And so we're going to be looking at this. Now, we're going to start in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 2. Daniel chapter 11, verse 2. It says, "And now will I show thee the truth." Now, when I read that, to me that means, okay, he's going to tell us the truth. But there's more to the meaning of that word truth than what we usually think of when it says, "I will show you the truth." If you turn with me back to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. Now, you know what happens in Daniel chapter 7. You've got four beasts, right? And Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 7, and Daniel chapter 8 all have symbolic prophecies, right? Chapter 2, chapter 7, chapter 8. Symbolism. And then after the symbolic prophecy, there's an explanation in each of those chapters, right? Chapter 2, Daniel explains the vision. Chapter 7, Gabriel comes and gives the explanation. Chapter 8, same thing. The angel comes and gives the explanation after the symbols are given. Notice with me here in Daniel chapter 7, beginning in verse 15. So the vision has been given to him in Daniel chapter 7 up through verse 14. And then it says in verse 15, "I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all of this." So he had just, do you think he was told a lie beforehand? No, that's not what the meaning of this word is. It's not like, "I was telling you a lie and now I'm going to tell you the truth." He says he was given all this symbolism and he says, "Now I want to know the truth of all this." So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. So when it says what the truth is, that means it's in straightforward language. This is the interpretation of it. This is so you can understand it, okay? So with that in mind, we go back to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 2, when he says, "Now I will show thee the truth," what he's saying is, I'm not going to fool around with you. I'm just going to tell you straightforward. This is the way it is. That is how chapter 11 is different from all the previous chapters in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 2, 7, and 8 are symbolism, and then they are followed by the explanation. Daniel 11 is straight explanation. So we're going to be looking at chapter 11, and I want you to understand this, that this is not symbolic language. These are not symbols like we have in chapter 2. You have a head of gold, silver breast and arms, or in chapter 7 where we have a lion and a bear and a leopard. Those are symbols, and the Bible explains itself. This is pure explanation. In fact, everything after Daniel 8:14, you know what Daniel 8:14 is? 2300 days. Everything after verse 14 of chapter 8 is all explanation of chapter 8. So that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with explanation in plain, straightforward language. So that's what it means when it says, I will tell you the truth. So let's read on here in chapter 11, verse 2. It says, behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. So three kings in Persia. That, what I want to focus on today is the fact that chapter 11 is so precise. We're talking about the precision of this chapter. This is prophecy. This was predicted in what are we missing? We're missing this. Oh no, it's not. This chapter was written in 535 BC. And in the verses that we're going to be looking at today, it's going to be looking forward up until like 2,000 years in advance, more than 2,000 years. We're going to be covering more than 2,000 years of history today in the next 20, 30 minutes. Okay? 2,000 years of history. But unlike chapter 2, where we have very broad picture. So you have, you know, head of gold, kingdom of Babylon. That's all it says about it. Breast and arms of silver is the kingdom of Medo-Persia. That's all chapter 2 says about it. There's going to be a kingdom. And we get all excited because, oh, you've got the whole history of the world outlined here. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. Wow, that's great. Daniel 11 is far more detailed than that. It goes into the nitty-gritty. It goes into so much detail. You know, our Adventist pioneers used to preach Daniel 11 all the time. That was one of their main evangelistic sermons, was Daniel 11. And huge crowds would come to hear them preach. And today, we don't even mention it in our evangelism. And so, the precision of this chapter, and the idea that God, so many years in advance, gave such detail so that we can understand, that we can trust the Word of God. It gives us guidance for today. Now, again, about this, the way we understand the Scriptures. The language of the Bible should be explained according to its obvious meaning. The language of the Bible should be explained according to its obvious meaning unless a symbol or figure is employed. Take the Bible as it reads. That's from Great Controversy 599. So, if there's a symbol, a leopard with four wings, that's obviously a symbol. There's no leopard out there that has four wings. This is obviously a symbol. Unless a symbol or figure is employed, we are to take the Bible as it reads. It should be explained according to its obvious meaning. This is the principle upon which Seventh-day Adventist understanding of the Bible is built. That unless there's a symbol or figure, it is to be understood according to its natural meaning. That's the rule that we're going to apply as we go through this chapter. Okay? So now, three kings yet in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they are. Here it lists them. Cambyses was Cyrus's son. Smerdis, whether you go with the true Smerdis or the false Smerdis, he went by the name Smerdis. We'll just call him Smerdis. And then there was Darius the Great, Darius the First. Those were the three kings that followed Cyrus in the Persian Empire. And then it says the fourth shall be far richer than they all. This Xerxes is the same as Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. And what do we read about Ahasuerus in the very first chapter of Esther? We read about his riches and his wealth. And so this was predicted long before Xerxes ever came on the scene. The guy wasn't even born yet when this was written. And so here it tells that he would be far richer than they all. And then notice the next thing that it says. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grisha. He shall stir up all against the realm of Grisha. Well, we happen to know what's going on there. That is the second Persian invasion of Greece. This was in 480 BC. This is a huge event in history. After 5 years of preparation with 1,200 ships, now Herodotus says 5 million men from 46 nations, that's kind of mind-boggling, and so modern historians say, well, he was exaggerating. He probably was. But even if it was 1 million men, we're talking a huge invasion. It says, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grisha. Built 2 pontoon bridges across the Hellespont, connecting Asia with Europe. I mean, this is a massive invasion of Greece. Historian Tom Holland, a very, very highly respected historian, wrote this book, Persian Fire, about this event. He says, in the 5th century BC, a global superpower was determined to bring truth and order to what it regarded as 2 terrorist states. Now picture this, huge superpower trying to rein in these 2 little terrorist states. The superpower was Persia, incomparably rich in ambition, gold, and men. The terrorist states were Athens and Sparta, eccentric cities in a poor and mountainous backwater Greece. The story of how their citizens took on the great king of Persia and thereby saved not only themselves, but Western civilization as well, is as heart-stopping and fateful as any episode in history. And then Tom Holland says, it's basically the most thrilling story in the whole of history. Now, this guy is a professional historian. He knows his stuff. Now, we would call probably the cross of Christ the most thrilling event in the whole of history. But according to this secular historian, this event was huge in its significance, and the Bible talks about it. You don't find this in Daniel 2. This is detail that the Bible is giving us here. It included the famous Battle of Thermopylae. Perhaps you've read or watched a television program about those 300 Spartans who stood against the entire army of Persia, you know, and they stood there defending Greece from them, you know, 300 against this huge, vast army. And then the Battle of Salamis, where the Athenians fought off the entire Persian fleet. And really, that's all in this verse 2 of Daniel chapter 11. Then it says in verse 3, and a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Who are we talking about? Alexander the Great, a mighty king. Again, Daniel 2 doesn't mention Alexander. Daniel 7 doesn't mention Alexander. Daniel 8 gets a horn in the goat's head, which is Alexander, that breaks off. But it's chapter 11 that tells us what this is all about. There's a mighty king that stands up and shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those. So here it tells us that the divisions, the four divisions into which his empire would be divided, would not be his descendants. It would not be his posterity. It would be others who come in and take up that kingdom in its divided state. And then it goes into verse 5 where it says, the king of the south shall be strong. So from verses 5 through 15, we have the kings of the south and the kings of the north. Now in context, we must understand these as the northern and southern areas of Alexander's empire. After he died, when it was divided into those four parts, what ended up happening was very quickly the Syrian power conquered Lysimachus, who was the king of the Thracian portion. And so now you're down to three. And then Macedonia kind of disappears from the scene in chapter 11. It doesn't really discuss Macedonia. So all you have left is the king of the north and the king of the south. These are the two powers that Daniel chapter 11 is looking at. So in context, the king of the north is the one who rules the northern territory of Alexander's empire. The king of the south is the one who rules the southern portion of Alexander's empire. And so here in these verses, in these next 10 verses or so, we have guys like Ptolemy the First, Ptolemy the Second, Ptolemy the Third, Ptolemy the Fourth, Ptolemy the Fifth. These guys are all in here, okay? You don't find that in Daniel chapter 8 or 7 or 2. These are details, and not only mentions them, it tells us what they do. And you go to history, everybody agrees. That's who these guys are being described. It tells exactly what they do. Then you have Seleucus the First. He looks like kind of a mean guy. You don't want to run into him at night. But then you have Antiochus the Second. You have Seleucus the Second. You have Seleucus the Third. These guys are all in here. They're all in this chapter. People we probably never heard of because we don't study history the way they used to. You know, in the olden days, they studied history. Today, you know, we have a watered-down form of history that we study, but it's not like we don't really know these guys. In fact, I never heard of them until I started studying Bible prophecy, and then I had to go to the history books to find out who are these guys, and they're all there. These are significant individuals. Antiochus the Third, Antiochus Magnus, or Antiochus the Great, very important person in history. He is given some good discussion here in Daniel chapter 11. He was the one. Let me try to describe a little bit about what he is here. So he is in the northern kingdom, the Syrian kingdom. And when Alexander's empire was divided up after his death, you have the king of the north and the king of the south. Palestine, Judea, fell under the control of Egypt, under the Ptolemies. So it was part of the kingdom of the south. And that was the way it was for 100 years, until Antiochus the Great comes along, and in the Battle of Panium in about 200 BC, he conquers the kingdom of the south. And from then on, now Judea is in the territory of the king of the north. And so that's why you end up with Antiochus Epiphanes, you know, who comes into Judea and messes everything up and desecrates the temple and all of that stuff. Now that story is not in Daniel 11, although that's what the dispensationalists and the preterists and so forth will tell you, that he's in here. I don't find him in this chapter at all, Antiochus the Fourth. Antiochus the Third is the one who is really talked about here. Now, That story that I just told you about him conquering the king of the south is in verse 15. The king of the north shall come up and cast up a mount, take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. So that's what's going on. Then it says in verse 16, but he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. Now, this is where we see a difference coming in between the Adventist interpretation and the non-Adventist interpretation. But recently, in recent years, there has been a newer Adventist interpretation which kind of agrees with the non-Adventist interpretation to a point. What I'm referring to is where we're seeing that there's a better application than what maybe some of our earlier men saw. But let's take verse 16 as we have generally understood this. So this is what I want to try to set up a framework for everything else I'm going to say in Daniel 11. Geographically, you have the king of the north, the king of the south, and then you have another power that comes in verse 16 as he that cometh against him. So what I'm suggesting is that he that cometh against him is neither the king of the north nor the king of the south. Because we've been talking about the king of the north in verse 15. So he that cometh against him is another power from another area who's coming in against the king of the north. That's how I'm presenting this to you. You see, as we mentioned, the north and the south have to do with the territories of the northern and southern territory of Alexander's empire after he died. But this power that comes in from the west, and it would be Rome, was not in the territory of Alexander's empire. It's totally, completely outside that area, and he's coming against the king of the north, so he's another power. And in fact, we do not see the expression king of the north between from verse 16 all the way through verse 39. We don't see the expression at all. All during that time, there is no king of the north. He's absent from the prophecy. He doesn't show up again until verse 40. So what I'm suggesting is that the camera is moving to the west there in verse 16, and it doesn't come back to the east to finish up the story until we get to verse 40, and then we see what happens with the kings of the north and the south. So now, what's going on here? We're going to notice in verse 16, I'm suggesting that verse 16 is when Rome came against the king of the north. This is the introduction of Rome into the prophecy. Now, I mentioned that there was a newer way of looking at this, and this is coming out of Andrews University. Roy Gain and some of the other ones have been studying this, and they have found a better application of some of these verses than what we have said in the past. Often we have gone to, immediately we go to Julius Caesar and Cleopatra and some of that stuff in the next few verses. But if you study some of the recent material coming out of Andrews, it appears that there is a better explanation in that verses 17 through 19 are actually telling out the rest of the story of Antiochus the Great. Because, for example, it tells us in verse 18, he turns his face to the isles, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Your version will read a little bit differently on that. This would be the Battle of Magnesia in 190 BC, where Scipio Asiaticus, now this is not Scipio Africanus. See, these guys, they were brothers. These were two Scipios, they were brothers. skip, they give you this title after the name. Once they have conquered a territory, they get that as a title that they get to carry around. So Scipio Africanus was victorious in major battle in North Africa, so he gets the title Africanus. This Scipio is Lucius Cornelius Scipio, and he's the guy who fights against Antiochus III and defeats him at the Battle of Magnesia, and so therefore he gets all of Asia for Rome, and so now he gets called Scipio Asiaticus. Anyway, this is famous Battle of Magnesia, and that's what they are now seeing in verse 18. And then he turns, verse 19, turns his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. And what he ended up doing was he was assassinated when he was trying to rob a temple to pay the heavy tribute to Rome that was inflicted on him because he lost this battle. And so, anyway, that's the current thinking on these verses. Then, of course, in verse 20, we're accustomed, oh, we love to talk about Caesar Augustus as a raiser of taxes, but in this new way of looking at it, the scholars are now going a different direction on this. The margin in my Bible doesn't say, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes, but it says, one that causeth an exactor to pass over. And so that exactor would be Pompey the Great. He was the one who actually went into Syria and annexed it for Rome. And this actually, you'll have to read Dr. Gaines' material on this. This actually fits the text a whole lot better. For example, where it says, within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Caesar Augustus, of all the emperors ruling from Rome, he ruled the longest. He ruled for 40 years. And so it wasn't just a few days. But Pompey, within a few years, if you use the year-day principle, within a few years he was assassinated and was destroyed. Whereas Caesar Augustus was not destroyed. He was not killed. He just died a natural death. So anyway, then we come to Julius Caesar, whereas the old view had Julius Caesar brought into the picture back in verse 17. The new view brings him in here in verse 21 as that vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. This is typically, in the old way of looking at this, Tiberius, but the problem there is that Tiberius was given the honor of the kingdom. He was the accepted one. Julius Caesar, he was not given, he took it. He declared himself dictator for life. He's the one who changed all the rules, and so he was more this vile person. There are some, however, who in this part of the chapter start jumping in straight into the papacy here. And this is where we start to see some differing in viewpoint. But whichever way you go with it, notice the detail that we're talking about in here. This is just, this every single word was fulfilled exactly as it's written here. So then we have Mark Antony, and this, if you go with the way Uriah Smith gives this story from verses 23 through 29, what you have here is the second triumvirate of Octavian and Mark Antony and Lepidus, and then the civil war between them. And so Mark Antony comes out in this story, and the Battle of Actium. Our pioneers understood that as verse 25 where it says, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. And so here you have this showdown, and this is where Cleopatra shows up in the picture, because she, with Mark Antony, are fighting against Octavian and his armies. And this was a major turning point. In fact, it's on this battle, the outcome of this battle is how we begin the imperial period of Rome. So up until then, it was a republic. And some of the foundations of the republic are being undermined by Caesar and some of the other ones. But at this point, after the fall of this triumvirate, when Octavian comes out conquering, he is now the ruler of the entire empire. And so this is where we begin our imperial period. And Caesar Augustus is now the first emperor of the Roman Empire. And so that's all here in Daniel chapter 11. If you want to study history, go to the Bible to find out what it talks about in history, and that'll tell you the important things to study in history. The Bible tells us what's important in history. And so these are the things, if you want to know, go to what the Bible talks about. And then, of course, the most important figure in all of history is Jesus, who is mentioned in verse 22 as the Prince of the Covenant. And so there we have the crucifixion right there in the center of the chapter. All right, now, one more person we want to mention here is Constantine. And according to the traditional Adventist view, he shows up in verse 29 as the one who moves the capital of the empire from Rome to Constantinople. And so that's Constantine there. You know, at this point now, we're going to move into some even greater detail as we go through just the next few verses. We're only going to take us up through verse 35 here, but I want to look at some history that may not be as familiar to you, but it is a crucial point in the history of the world. Verse 30. Daniel 11, verse 30. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him. And traditionally, we have understood this as the barbarian invasions. And this was a very significant turning point in the history of Rome. You see, in Daniel chapter 2, we have legs of iron, and then what comes after the legs of iron? Feet of iron and clay. And it says, the kingdom shall be divided. And so you have the division of the Roman Empire. In Daniel chapter 7, we have the fourth beast has how many horns? 10 horns. Again, the division of the Roman Empire. It's not a new empire. It's the breakup of the Roman Empire into these 10 divisions. And so in chapter 11, we have these invasions of these Germanic peoples coming in. And that was a very significant change. In fact, so often in our discussion of history, we often just skip over it and we talk about pagan Rome and papal Rome as if one immediately follows the other. We miss this vital in-between element of these barbarians, these Germanic peoples who come in and take over. Now, the Gothic invasions, notice this is showing from the mid-3rd century. See those arrows coming down through the Black Sea, and it gives the date 256 and 268. These were the earliest Gothic invasions into the Roman Empire in the middle of the 3rd century. And it says here, the ships of Kittim shall come against him. So when we're talking about the ships of Kittim, we're talking about invasions, but of course we all automatically think of the Vandals who had their attacks by sea. But even before the Vandals, that was in the 400s, even back in the mid-3rd century, we have these Gothic invasions. And so I believe that the ships of Kittim is a general term to reference the barbarian invasions as a whole into the Roman Empire. So if we're going to go with at least this these early invasions, the first major victory of the Goths over the Romans was the Battle of Adrianople in 378 AD. This was the first major defeat that the Romans had had in like 600 years. You know, nobody defeats Rome. And that's the way it had been for more than half of a millennium. But now these Goths come in and fight against Valens, who was the emperor, and he's killed, and the Roman army is decimated by these Goths. This was a huge blow to Rome. And then the verse here, verse 30 says, "Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant." Now, I'm taking the position that the storyline in Daniel 11 is following the civil rulers. And so I'm suggesting that them that forsake the Holy Covenant is the church, the Roman church, the Roman bishops who have forsaken the Holy Covenant. They have apostatized. And so Theodosius was the emperor who, more than anybody else, was responsible for making sure that Catholicism would be the religion of the empire. He ruled out paganism, shut down all the pagan temples, and he also ruled out all other forms of Christianity except Catholicism. He was the one who in 380 BC, or AD, when he was baptized, came up out of the baptistry and made an edict, we call it the Edict of Thessalonica, in which he said, he defined the religion of Catholicism and said, this will be the religion of the empire. No other form of Christianity is to even be allowed or in existence. And then he made one edict after another for the next 15 years, that was making more and more emphasizing the fact that the religion of Catholicism would be the only acceptable religion in the realm. So, if we're talking about have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant, this picture is illustrating a point in time when he had really done something terrible. He had slaughtered a whole bunch of people, and he was because he had done that, the Bishop Ambrose of Milan like excommunicated him, and so he is now coming back in penance to receive once again the favor of the bishop. And so this is an alliance that he has with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. But I want to give you another possible way of looking at this verse also. We talked about the Vandals when we're talking about the ships of Kittim. And of course, this was in the mid-400s AD. And let's read this from the perspective of them being what is focused on here as the ships of Kittim. And it says, "Shall come against him." Therefore, he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Now, let's look at it from this perspective now. After the fall of the last Roman emperor in the West, which was 476 AD, Romulus Augustulus, the last emperor is deposed. After the fall of the last Roman emperor in the West, the storyline in Daniel 11 continues with the most prominent of the Germanic kings. Because what happens when in chapter 2, the legs extend down into the feet of iron and clay. It's those Germanic kings. In chapter 7, you have the ten horns is the extension of the Roman Empire. So the focus goes to the ten horns. Before it goes to the little horn, you have to talk about the ten horns. And so I'm suggesting that the one who succeeds the Roman Empire are these Germanic peoples. And so we want to follow the line of Daniel 11, the storyline continuing with the most prominent of the Germanic kings. And who was that? So this is the historian George Burton Adams in his book Civilization During the Middle Ages. He says it was the Franks alone of all the German tribes who became a wide power in the general history of the Middle Ages. It is to them that the political inheritance of the Roman Empire passed. To them came the honor of taking up and carrying on, roughly to be sure, and far less extensively and effectively, but nevertheless of actually carrying on the political work which Roman had been doing. So I want to trace this. If we're following the line of the most prominent of the Germanic kings, that would be the Franks. Let's see how that fits into this picture, and that brings us to Clovis. Who was Clovis? Well, he was the king of the Franks. And it tells us there, this is, therefore he shall be grieved, if we're applying this to Clovis, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Clovis was a pagan. But he had a conversion experience. And here he is being baptized by the Bishop of Reims, France. And so he, like Theodosius before him, had intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. He formed an alliance with the Catholic Church. His wife was Catholic. Now, let's get the perspective here. All of these tribes, these Germanic tribes that came into the Roman Empire, they did not come in as pagans. Eight of the ten, if you want to put a number on there, eight of the ten came in as Christians. Only two of the tribes were pagan, the Franks and the Anglo-Saxons. All the rest of them were Arian Christians. And so they're coming into the Roman Empire, and Benjamin Wilkinson says in his book, Truth Triumphant, they came in and they were surprised to find out that they were not accepted in this Christian nation. Here they're coming in as Christians, but they're not Catholic, you see, and so they were not accepted. So, so Clovis comes in. This is what H.H. Milman says in the book History of Latin Christianity. Clovis was a pagan, then only the chief of about 4,000 Frankish warriors. His conversion issued in events of profound importance to mankind. And then James Harvey Robinson in the book Introduction to the History of Western Europe says, certainly Clovis quickly learned to combine his own interests with those of the church. And the alliance, the alliance between the Pope and the Frankish kings was to have a great influence upon the history of Western Europe. That is why Europe became Catholic, was because of two people. First of all, Theodosius. Secondly, Clovis. Now, to get some perspective on this, here's a map of what it looked like in 500 AD. You have the Eastern Empire, which is ruled by the Eastern Emperor, and of course, that's all Catholic. The West, what has happened to the West? All of these barbarian tribes have come in, none of which are Catholic. None of which are Catholic. And the three main ones that are obstructing the Bishop of Rome from having control of the West are the Ostrogoths in Italy, the Vandals in North Africa, and the Visigoths, who control all of Spain and Gaul. Those three tribes. Now, you probably learned that it was the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Visigoths. Modern scholarship, the material coming out of the Biblical Research Institute is saying that's not the best three to go with, but the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths and the Vandals is a much better, and we don't have time to go into that, but read the material from the BRI on that. So here you've got a problem. The Bishop of Rome cannot be the head of all the holy churches. He cannot be in charge in the West because all of these Arians are controlling the whole territory. So those three tribes have to be uprooted in order for the Bishop of Rome to gain power. And the first of those to go is the Visigoths. Notice what Clovis says in 507, as he announces his intention to conquer the Visigoths. He says, "It grieves me to see that the Arians still possess the fairest portion of Gaul. Let us march against them with the aid of God, and having vanquished the heretics, we will possess and divide their fertile provinces." Did you notice the word that he used? It grieves me. So if we're following the line here of, and by the way, that's from Edward Gibbon, History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. If we follow the rule here that the history in Daniel 11 is being carried on with the most prominent of the Germanic kings, what did that most prominent of the Germanic kings do? When it says, "He shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant, so shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant." And so what we see here is the alliance between Clovis and the bishops of Rome, and what he set about to do as the result of that, to drive out the heretics, because he was grieved at them being there. Now, verse 31, it says, "And arms shall stand on his part." And that means an army, and you probably have a version that says that more clearly than mine. "An army shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate." Now, when we go to Daniel chapter 12, verse 11, it tells us exactly when that would happen. Because if you follow Daniel 12, you have a question in verse 6, "How long shall it be to the end of these wonders?" And the end of these wonders would be 1798. "How long shall it be to the end of these wonders?" And it gives two answers to that question. The first question is in verse 7, 260 days. It uses in the phrase of time times and a half. The second answer is in verse 11, where it says, "And from the time that the daily is taken away and the abomination of desolation set up, there shall be 1290 days. And so we know from that, if we count back, that it was in 508 that the daily was taken away. So we can, without any doubt, verse 31 of Daniel 11 has to happen in 508. 508 was the date of the conclusion of the war between Clovis and the Visigoths. That was when the battle was concluded and he had conquered the Visigoths completely. And so that's what's going on there in Daniel 11, verse 31. In the book, The Beginning of the Middle Ages, it says, "Nor was his a temporary conquest. The kingdom of the West Goths had become the kingdom of the Franks." The invaders had at length arrived who were to remain. It was decided that the Franks and not the Goths were to direct the future destinies of Gaul and Germany, and that the Catholic faith was to be the religion of these great realms. William Shea says that this was a theological victory for the Bishop of Rome. And so that was why this is in the Bible. It was a decisive turning point in history that determined that Catholicism would be the religion of these great realms. And so that was what we see there. Now, reading on, if we're going to follow this line of French rulers, it says in verse 32, "And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries." Let's say that the he is still the French rulers. And so what did they do? We have alliances continuing on between the French rulers and the Bishop of Rome. And so, again, those who do wickedly against the covenant are the bishops and the pontiffs of Rome, and the rulers, the kings, are corrupting them by flatteries. And so we have kings like Pepin and Charlemagne. These are the guys who boosted the authority and rank of the Bishop of Rome, the papacy. And then in verse 33, well, the second part of verse 32, "But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. Yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by spoil many days." And so we have people like the Waldenses and others who stood firm for the truth down through those dark ages, even though they fell by the sword, by flame, by captivity, by spoil many days. Verse 34, "Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed." And so here we have this story giving details all the way down through the Dark Ages, period. And so what I want to leave you with is this statement from The Great Controversy, page 321. And it's talking about William Miller and his principles. And next time we're going to look at a couple of William Miller's rules. But as William Miller was carving out the framework that would become Seventh-day Adventist understanding of prophecy, this is the rule that he followed. Taking the manner in which the prophecies had been fulfilled in the past as a criterion by which to judge of the fulfillment of those which were still future. That was a rule that he followed. However the prophecies have been fulfilled in the past, that's the manner in which we should expect them to be fulfilled in the future. So next time we will look at that last part of Daniel 11 where it gets controversial. But we're going to use this rule. We're going to follow how it was fulfilled in the past, and every word was fulfilled exactly as it was written. We're going to apply that in the last half of Daniel chapter 11, and we will see that there is an amazing word-for-word fulfillment just the way it was in the past. Well, don't forget the verse. Those things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope.